Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are many podcasts competing for your time and attention. We hope to bring you the content and guests to be your go-to podcast for the study of war, warfare, and strategy. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you find this episode both entertaining and informative. Okay, welcome back to the Revolution of Military Affairs podcast. I have a cup full of two Red Bulls right here, and plan on talking about tanks today, so it should be a lively conversation. On today's podcast, we have John Nimmons. He's a friend of mine. We've known each other for several years now, and we've worked together a couple times across those years, and so John, thanks for coming on the podcast today to talk to me about tanks.
Yeah, thanks. Excited to be here.
All right. Just as a disclaimer, anything that John says is representative only of himself and not his employer. And so just keep that in mind. Same thing for me, but that's just standard. For another right. Couple months, I'm almost retired, and then it's just it is what it is. So anyway, John, we're going to talk about tanks today. And the reason we're going to talk about tanks is you co-authored a paper. Has it really been August when that was published? August of 2023? So anyhow, the paper was published in Military Review. It's called The Tank is Dead. Long Live the Tank, the Persistent Value of Armored Combined Arms Teams in the 21st Century. And so I wanted to talk to John about that because, you know, I'm one of those futurists that thinks that drones and sensors are going to obviate the need for tanks on future battlefields. I'm being completely facetious, and that's not the case at all. So with that said, I guess I'll get into a couple questions, but what inspired the idea to write this paper, John?
Yeah, so it was really the child of a lot of discussions from the workplace, honestly, with different leaders across the Army. And, you know, much like you talked about in your previous podcast with Professor Black, there had been a lot of discussion at higher levels of kind of, you know, the obsolescence of tanks based off Nagorno-Karabakh and some of the stuff that we were seeing in the Ukraine conflict. And really what it boiled down to for us was, you know, we felt that people were overemphasizing some tactical errors on the battlefield, as opposed to looking at it from a much larger point of view, which is the strategic impact it can provide, the operational impact that it can provide. And then, of course, when part of a combined arms team, what it can do. I thought the point was spot on again from your previous podcast that the tank by itself does have its limitations, but the beauty of the way it's designed is it really augments a combined arms team. And that's really what we wanted to get after and show the linkage between tactical, operational, and strategic.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that folks, when they look at things, they look at things in isolation of the bigger picture. And a lot of times too, this idea of combined arms like that, the tank is fundamentally an element of combined arms and it can't be used in isolation of that. And if it is being used in isolation of that, it's being used incorrectly. The other thing too is, I think folks forget too, tanks weren't designed to kill tanks. And so using tanks in that capacity, if you think back to the U.S. Army and how it originally developed tanks, there were tank destroyers and then there were tanks, and they were two separate things. They were two separate career fields. And, you know, the tank destroyers went away and the tank picked up that role to a degree, but it was still basically held the idea that you're supposed to penetrate, get to the rear and start running amok in the rear, killing supplies, killing artillery, killing command posts. And not really being wedded to the slow, methodical approach to fighting. And so I just say that to say a lot of people, I think, don't appreciate where the tank originated and what it was for to begin with. I mean, originally, like, so First World War, it was for, you know, getting through machine guns and getting through no man's land and all that. But the evolution of that idea in the Second World War, I always thought that Patton had a really good phrase, and I paraphrase it, but it was something to the effect of, you know, tanks aren't meant to kill tanks. They're meant to get in the rear area. He called it something like the happy hunting field of the tank. And so anyway, I still have to say, why is it, and you answered this a little bit, why is it that the these, I don't even want to say innovative breakthroughs in technology, but these evolutions in technology have not necessarily rendered the tank obsolete. And I say that like, you know, we've got drones. Why have drones not, or why will drones not render the tank obsolete, and why will it still have a place on the battlefield? And then I want to come back to Nagorno-Karabakh, because that's kind of the big thing that everybody points to.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting question, right? And it's something that we've definitely discussed a lot of work. What I could say is when you look at military doctrine, when you look at tactics, there are some very fundamental things about that, regardless of technology.
Yeah.
Right. And being able to apply those fundamentals and then overlay it with tech kind of changes the flavor of the dish you're making, mm-hmm. but it's still the same dish. Right. So you don't want to get carried away with the idea that the technology itself is going to somehow fundamentally change the doctrine or the tactics. Now, that might be the case much further in the future.
Yeah.
But for today's ground conflict, you know, I think it's still very much less about the tank itself in terms of like, has it become obsolescent or not? And it's more of a question of getting back to some military principles, which are mass, concentration, audacity, and tempo, if we look at offensive operations, right? And there's this idea that we can somehow forego that with precision technology or with upgraded tech when, no, those principles are still there. They're still part of the offensive operations. And if we want to be successful, we need to remember that. And it goes a little bit further than the tech itself.
One of the things that I think is forgotten in this conversation, it goes back to the principles of combined arms too, right? It's that, and all of this factors into a couple things, right? So there's the terrain. First and foremost, you have to put everything in context of the terrain. And if you're trying to use tanks in mountainous terrain or in urban terrain, regardless of the situation, they're going to be sub-optimized to a degree anyway, because they're not really meant. I mean, they don't perform as well in that type of terrain, right? When we think of tanks, we usually think of them rolling around in open desert, you know, especially because a lot of us have so much experience at the National Training Center where it's just a wide open desert. But, you know, so there's that. But then when you put the tank in mountainous terrain where it's slow moving and it's hard to hide and you can't really do much, and then you apply that combined arms element where you have the enemy with the ability to see you from above and shoot down at you, and you don't have the ability to shoot up and take out and eliminate those things in the sky, which is what you saw in Nagorno-Karabakh. then it is a bit of an asymmetric advantage, but it's only an asymmetric advantage because of the terrain in which it's being used and the way it's being used, and then the lack of, you know, the other side's ability to counter that technology. And I think that that's the part of this discussion that's often overlooked. You know, you have folks come in and give these presentations that have these really cool YouTube videos of drones zapping tanks in the mountains in Nagorno-Karabakh. And they're like, this is the way of the future, you know, and then you get a lot of folks out there that just take it for what it's take it for what it is and don't look at it in the bigger context. And this is one of the things that I've called looking at wars in a fishbowl as opposed to wars on a pond or wars on a lake, right? The effects of something in a fishbowl are magnified significantly. If you throw a pebble into a fishbowl, it's going to create a pretty big ripple, right? You throw that same pebble, that same size pebble in a pond, and it's going to be, you know, diminished quite a bit. And so the same idea, I think, applies when you look at like drones, right? Drones in the mountains versus a force that doesn't have the capacity to counter that is going to be a lot different than drones in a big ass open field. Even if they don't have the ability to counter that, it's still going to be a significantly different outcome. And I think that that's part of it too, is you've got to factor in this equation here of size disparity and the size of the front. I think looking at that, you mentioned precision strike. Like, how does that compare with the idea of the tank looking into the future as well?
So the precision strike, when I'm talking about that, I'm looking at precision artillery fire or something from a drone or something from an aircraft. You know, all of that is amazing stuff, and it absolutely has a place on the battlefield, you know, for the instant detractors who might say I'm dismissing it. I'm not. But I'm looking at it from a much larger strategic perspective. And what I mean by that is you can't produce precision munitions as fast and as quickly as you can other munitions.
Yeah.
Right. And if you look at the Ukraine, for example, it is absolutely a question of magazine depth. What do I have available to me to continue the fight? And that goes back to your industrial base conversation of, can I quickly produce what I need to sustain an operation or sustain a war? And I think the value of a tank in this case is it's a kind of combination of the two, because I would consider it precision, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's not precision guided, as it were, with a artillery round or something coming from an aircraft.
Yeah.
And but you can also employ it in mass at a relatively lower cost than you could those other munitions. And then, oh, by the way, the one thing that a lot of people forget is those other assets are greatly affected by the weather. You know, you talked about the enemy and the terrain. I'll throw the weather out there too. And a tank is a all weather system that can continue to fight, you know, regardless of what is thrown at you. And I think you bring up a good point, right? The enemy gets a vote, the terrain gets a vote, the weather gets a vote. And when you lay those three very complex things on top of each other, what do you have that can allow you to continue to fight, you know? So, and again, like as a student of history, I think I find it fascinating. I always talk about the Battle of Agincourt and how, you know, everyone thought that the English longbow was like this great superior piece of technology against French knights, when in reality, studies have shown that those arrows didn't penetrate the French knights. It had rained. The armor of the French knights, it had rained pretty significantly the night before the battle, and the field was so muddy that the arrow had the ability to knock them off the horse, but they either drowned in the mud or the French longbowmen were able to come and stab them through the eye slits of their helmets. Right. And so that is the nuance of the kind of conversations that we should be having, because we don't want to learn wrong lessons.
I often wonder, like, what's the point of a land force then if we're trying to like precision our way out of close fights, right? And I'm not a big fan of that phrase, close fight and deep fight and all that. But at the end of the day, like that last, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, that last mile or whatever of the fight, that requires, you know, some pretty close combat and people getting, you know, fighting really close to one another, right? And yes. You can't, again, there's many reasons that precision is probably not the right answer, right? So cost is one, and then cost and capacity, you know, like how much can you actually carry? How much do you have on hand? How much can you shoot? You know, and I think this is one of those things where we forget that a lot of the more exquisite, expensive capabilities are also retained at higher echelon. And just because you're over there slugging it out in a fight doesn't mean that big picture, when you step up to the next higher level of command or the next higher level of command, that your little fight over here is something that this guy over here, that, you know, two level up leader finds important, you know. And it may be like, hey, good luck to you. I took your artillery and I took this and I took that. But I still need you to go consume the enemy's combat power over here on our flank just to consume combat power for no other reason. And yes. I think that's something that people forget. And the tank is very good at doing that. Again, it can't do it on its own, right? But as a tanker, I know, and I know you know, that a canister round getting popped off can definitely help clear an area. I just was rewatching the movie Napoleon last night, you know, and at the when they put down the loyalist uprising there, Bonaparte hits them with the whiff of grape shot. It always reminds me. I always poke my wife because she came out one time to family day when I was a tank company commander, and we shot some canister rounds for everybody. And I remember the shock on their face when they heard it all pinging around down the range and everything, you know. But I say all that to say, you know, I think it's important to not. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the what is it? I would call it a distraction almost, but the YouTube-ification and TikTok-ification of talking about warfighting, right? You know, so again, like I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that are like, look at this great video of these Turkish drones taking out these old T-72s or whatever, you know? Like that, I think, has limited utility in the big picture understanding of things. And so I'm just curious if you see – what your thoughts are on that whole phenomenon at this point.
Right. I mean, social media is a double-edged sword. I think, you know, if you're in the information space and you're trying to convey a message, obviously with an ulterior motive, then it's useful because a lot of people aren't going to really go beyond the 30-second clip or the 160 characters that you're, you know, spitting stuff out at. But what I caution people on with that is, you know, that stuff is like reading a paragraph from a book and then thinking you know everything that the book is about, right? It's very hard to really get
the full story. Talking about
right, like you, yeah. I mean, candidly, there were probably some books and Sam's that I did that with, right? You're just trying to cut, you know, make it through class, but it's hard to get the message and the detail behind the message. You might understand the message, but you might not necessarily understand all the detail. And the other part of it too is it's easy to manipulate, right? And yeah. I think that's, if you have an agenda, right, then it's easy to pick and choose which pieces of media you want to share that kind of support your conclusion, which, you know, is of course the antithesis of what we do, cherry pick information to confirm our own bias. But that was actually something we were very careful about and discussed a lot when we wrote the article, right? Because there are counter arguments out there that I think should be discussed, and I think namely, probably the maintenance and sustainment of the tank is one that needs to be discussed. And it is a legitimate concern for those who, you know, kind of say the tank might be obsolete. I don't think it's obsolete because it's a maintenance or sustainment. But I think that there are some challenges there that should be looked at.
Yeah, the maintenance part, I think. This goes back to don't create your own problems. You know what I mean? Like, I know you've been an XO, an executive officer, and so
there's a lot of chain in what I just said.
Yeah, and a lot of that I think is self-inflicted because we've thrown so much crap onto a tank, you know, and it's only been built to do so many things 40 years ago, and we keep throwing new and new stuff on it, and part of it too, like deployability. That's a legitimate counter argument against the tank, or at least our tank. you know, is it's so heavy that it's not really all that deployable at this point.
Right.
And so I think that gets back to, you know, like that, in my opinion, that creates a demand signal for the people that are, you know, run the show and develop things, like make a smaller, lighter tank. You still need the capacity of a tank. You may not necessarily need a 70-ton tank with all the things, but I would argue, like, as long as it's still got the fire control system on it and it can stop some stuff and it can move fast and it can get thrown on a boat quick, you know, yeah, then you're good. And so I think that that's one of the things that, in addition to the maintenance or counter arguments against it, but I think those also are just things that, like, okay, that's true, you're correct. So let's make a smaller, lighter tank that's probably got maybe a little less punch. But again, based off what you're seeing on the battlefield, do you necessarily need all the things that are on the tank today that we have? And so I think that that's something worth considering. What are some of the other counter arguments that you think have legitimacy?
Probably the biggest one that stands out to me is the weight issue that you talked about. Our military is supposed to be deployable, exportable around the globe. And having traveled a significant portion of the globe, I don't know too many bridges that can withstand the weight of the tank, which forces us into wet gap crossings.
Are slow and deliberate and resource intensive. And
yes.
Very much put out a visual signature and an audible signature that's quite easy for an adversary to pick up.
Absolutely. And you lose, you know, part of the, you know, one of the arguments in the paper was the operational reach and tempo that it provides. Well, that has a limitation when you start looking at the terrain, specifically, say, in the Indo-Pacific theater, or if you're looking in Eastern Europe, or all of Europe, really, for that matter. So that is definitely something that I think could limit it. There are ways to overcome it. But if we kind of like look at the future of tanks and armored warfare, increasing its mobility, because this goes back to my point about precision, right? Because we originally talked about, like,
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Why are we so focused on precision? And I think it's because there's a desire for sterile warfare. Like, and warfare is not sterile. Like you said, you have to close with and destroy, and that is a very bloody thing. So it's the more gadgets we can put on the tank to make it more lethal, the more protected we are. I think there's a trade-off at some point to being a little bit more agile than, you know, you're a football guy, you know, and if you look at some of the defenses that don't necessarily have the guys that can compete with 350-pound offensive linemen, they go for more agile guys, especially at the, you know, defensive end position, so that they can get around them to get to the quarterback. And I think that's a valuable idea. You don't necessarily want to go pound for pound with somebody if you can outrun them, if you know what I mean.
I got a quick football story since you brought up football. So for those who aren't aware, I used to coach football before I got started in the career that I'm currently in. And I coached high school ball for a year and I coached college ball for 2 years. And when I was coaching college football, my coach was an older guy. He'd been around for a while. He started in the 70s. He was a grad assistant at Penn State. And anyhow, we'd be watching film and he – We weren't the best. We weren't the best team, and we'd be watching film of our guys, and we'd be like, "Look at that guy's hips. He can't move. We got nothing but donkeys." And I always thought it was so funny. He called the bad players donkeys. So that's something I've carried forward. And when I watch football with my family, my wife always jokes and we'll throw that phrase out because I've told that story so many times in my house. The point on back to the thesis here, if you will. Yeah. Back to closing with and destroying the enemy. I think that's the part of this that people forget about too, right? So, and you guys kind of you hit on it, but I'm going to make it a little bit more transparent here. I think critical point, both tactically all the way up to politically, is the threat that you will kill everything that you have to within the rules of war, right? To achieve your political goal, right? Yes. And so that's a fairly wide, you know, set of things that you can do to bring about what it is that you're trying to bring about militarily speaking. And so with that, you know, your adversary has to understand that too, because there's this trade-off, right? And you guys talk about it a bit in the paper, the signaling, right? And by saying that the tank is obsolete, you remove one of your abilities to actually put down a credible signal on the battlefield, right? And a signal, not only in the just like, hey, look what we can do sense, but an actual like, hey, we've got this thing that will come through and kill everything along the way and destroy everything along the way until you give up. Because at the end of the day, right, victory is about forcing the enemy to change its plan, right? Or causing them to quit. Those are really essentially the two things that you get to at the end of the day. And the tank, regardless of what you've got going on, helps you bring about one of those two points. And again, it goes back to the combined arms thing. I think this is where you really have to understand combined arms, right? And again, it's not a hard concept. It's paper, rock, scissor, essentially.
Yes, you know? It is.
And you can't just come out and throw rock every time and expect to win, right?
Right.
And that's what, like, I think some of these people that try and take down the tank try and say, you know, and it's, no, we need to have all these capabilities. The other thing I think that's important in this conversation, too, is appreciating the challenge-response dynamic. And just because drones right now seem to be, like, the cool thing that's going on, you know, all these FPV drones, you know, that are going out and doing these discrete drops in the hatches of tanks and then zooming away. Like, for one, that's just a, like, one shot of one thing within a small engagement. Like, that's not having any kind of effect beyond killing the people in that tank and perhaps destroying that tank. And I think taking a lot of this stuff at scale is something that, mm-hmm. that gets overlooked, too. And so I'm just curious what your thoughts are on everything I just said. I hope you're taking notes.
Well, I mean, I'll address the drones and the scale piece because those really resonated. You know, again, I think drones absolutely have a place on the battlefield. Yeah. And I think they do provide value in a combined arms fight. Yeah. Right. And what you're not seeing, and maybe it is existing, it's just not being shared across social media, is how the drone is being implemented in a combined arms fight. You know, it is to a degree, but ultimately I think if you want to talk about scale, it's drones that can identify enemy positions, that can confirm for people as they execute a battle where to go, that can support indirect fire and other precision munitions at the same time that you are also unleashing violence with a tank and anti-tank missiles from infantry squads, right? All of that stuff together. And oh, by the way, I'll throw EW on it. Like, while I'm doing that, I'm also jamming you. So when I do that at a very specific point in a battle, or at scale to a much larger effect, I can then achieve that goal that you're talking about, where I'm going to force him to quit because he's going to say, I can't see, I can't talk, and I'm getting overwhelmed with fire. I have no choice but to leave this position. If I give up this position, I'm giving up an operational goal, which ultimately hopefully ties to a strategic goal. And that's what you want to see, right? And the tank is just one part of that. The scale piece is important. Right. And we've talked about it throughout this conversation. But you're not, and that's not to say that it won't happen, but drones at scale, right?
Yeah.
Like they're important, but I'm not sure that, you know, again, it's, you could have drones at scale, but if, you know, you're going to attack and it starts to rain or you have bad wind, then what?
Yeah, well, that, and I think the other thing with that too, when you talk about drones at scale, is the munition capacity, right? So, like, if you're dropping one thing and then flying away, or firing two things and then flying away, like you have limited utility in any kind of large scale thing, right? A lot of those FPV drones, like, but they drop like one thing and then they got to fly away. You know, they can't fly at night. And then again, all this stuff, a lot of those things, I think, will get worked out with time, right? Yeah, right. You know, like the being able to see at night and the weather, they'll be able to compensate a bit more. But some of it, like if you've got these little tiny drones, like physics says they're only going to be able to lift so much. And by only being able to lift so much, they're only going to be able to pack so much of a punch, you know, with the munitions that they're able to deliver. And so that's why I think it's also one of those things, people that are like, oh, drone swarms, it's going to, you know, it's going to take out the tank's utility in the future. Well, I don't know that that's true, because, you know, the size of the swarm and the number of munitions they're going to be able to carry probably aren't going to be enough to do anything significant on the battlefield.
I'd like to add something there. And I mean, I'm open to being wrong. I really am. But the aerial threat, you know, minus the past 20 years, has always been a thing. And to me, you know, I just see it as another aerial threat that people have had to face previously in other conflicts. Something that's necessarily new.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That's one of my counter arguments to the big drones are revolutionary crowd. Like, no, they're not. Like, it's just, that's, again, we've had since, you know, whatever, World War I-ish, we've always had things flying through the air that we've had to pay attention to. And so this is really no different. The size is slightly different and the potential number of things are slightly different. But at the same time, this challenge response dynamic that I always talk about means that eventually the responder is going to answer the challenge, right? We're going to develop sufficient things that can take out drones to the point where they become nothing, right? Like, whether it's a huge electronic signal that hits the sky and they all fall from the sky, or some giant laser beam that hits all these things and fries their motherboards, or whatever the case may be. I'm sure those are already in development too, you know, or some giant net, you know, that like goes up and does all this stuff. So like, it's one of those things. And again, like, I think there's different, the smaller drones to me are less frightening, potentially, than the bigger drones. The bigger drones, I think, are the ones that are a bit more threatening. But at the same time, again, it goes back to capacity too. Like, they fire off whatever number of things and they got to fly away, you know, or they stay in orbit and then they do a handoff. But even then, like, you're talking capacity, you're talking cost of munitions, right? How many Hellfires or whatever it is can you hook up on this thing? Before you run out of money or before you run out of Hellfires, and then you're like waiting on boats coming through the middle of the ocean to get there with your munitions. So anyway, I think that's one of the things that I think is often overlooked in this conversation. I also think just some people have axes to grind, you know, like, oh, tanks. I don't like tanks, you know, never have. So let's just use this to tear it down. But let me, I just wanted to look, there was something else on your paper that I was going to comment on. That was an interesting piece there too. Tanks also constitute a powerful endorsement of peace initiatives. I think, you know, and that's, you guys have that on page 3 of your paper, and it's hard to take, and I say this not being condescending or intentionally mean to any other military, but it's hard to take a military serious, you know, if it doesn't have, like, hardware out there that looks intimidating and can actually do something. And so, you know, big picture, especially for the U.S., I think to your point in the paper, and I'll pass it off to you after I say this, but to your point on that symbol of national power, I think it truly is. It helps send that signal that, hey, you know, like, we have a credible land force that is more than capable of coming in and doing bad things if we have to.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we pointed it out too, of, you know, all the nations that saw its potential value, to increase its value as a military, and what they sought to do with it. And, you know, you look at what we talked about with China boasting the largest, tank force in the world. You know, there's a reason why, certain militaries pursue that, and, you know, us being one of them. And the ability to project that, often, you know, if you're trying to search for, you know, political and strategies of deterrence, right? The ability to put a large armored force somewhere, the ability to, not actually doing it, just the ability to, is going to change the calculus of, some people, right? So I think that's an important consideration to have, in terms of its value, because you not only want military options, because the military does help derive a political or drive policy, maybe with violent means. But if you have that deterrent there, you're providing your nation some flexible alternatives that they might not necessarily have.
Plus, it looks cool too.
Nothing's cooler than the way the M1 looks, in my opinion, but I acknowledge I am biased.
I totally agree with you on that. So I guess as we get ready to wrap up here, is there anything about this argument that we haven't hit that you wanted to hit?
I think this has been a great discussion. I've really enjoyed it. It was a fun article to write with a team of people and take a lot of discussions, you know, water cooler discussions, if you will, and put them on paper, and put it out there. I was surprised at the response, to it. And if nothing else, it just gives people something to think about and consider, which is, you know, ultimately, you know, what you're looking for, especially, when the business that we do is serious and, we'd like people to seriously consider what we do.
But certainly it was timely, because at the beginning of the war with the war between Russia and Ukraine, again, people immediately started jumping on the tank is dead thing, just because they saw some anti-tank weapons for the first time, you know, and that's what I think is funny. Like, just because it's your first time seeing it, Mr. Reporter or Mr. Scholar or whomever, doesn't mean that this hasn't existed for a long time. And, you know, like Panzerfausts were zapping M4s, you know, back in Berlin as we were closing on, well, not Berlin, because we didn't go to Berlin. We let the Russians take that, or the Soviets rather. But, you know, the point remains, you know, as we were closing on, Berlin, you know, as we got closer, especially as anti-tank systems became more and more popular, because of the reduced range that they were, you know, the Germans were defending from as we were moving in towards the capital. And so I think that's one of those things. It's, you just, sometimes you have to shake your head, and I don't say that in a condescending way, but, like, again, is this your first time seeing this? Is this your first time being introduced to the idea of combined arms, where, like, something in the sky can easily take out something on the ground if there isn't something on the ground that's also looking at the sky to take out stuff in the sky, you know? And so it's like every time a new conflict starts, it's like the first time it's ever happened. So I think presentism often gets in the way of understanding the context of things and, like, why, you know, for this, in the case of this discussion, tanks are always going to be, it's the same thing too. Like, you know, you can make the same argument about light infantry, right? But arguably, like, there are, again, going back to context, you know, situations in which light infantry are good and situations in which, you know, like, I would much rather have anything in the world but light infantry, right?
Right.
You know, it's one of those things we have to keep into consideration too. Is, you know, I was in a discussion a while back, and a senior person said something to the effect of how airborne forces will be obsolete in the future. And, you know, because of all the things that can shoot down planes. And, you know, it makes you scratch your head, because you're like, what are you talking about? You know, I don't think that there's going to be like this need for this massive airborne force, but, you know, there is still going to be like, I think, a need potentially. And it may not be like strategic airborne forces flying from, you know, bases in the U.S. across the globe to go jump in somewhere. But in intra theaters, probably, certainly, you know?
Right.
And so, anyhow, it's just one of those things. It's always, I wish I could remember that meme, that the dude with the butterfly, and he's like, is this combined arms warfare? You know what I'm talking about? You know that meme?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
That's what I feel like half the time when, like, I hear these arguments, like, the tank's dead. Is there anything else that, any hot takes out there that you think are total horse crap that you want to riff on for a minute?
I think my biggest hot take, these are dangerous, right? Again, these are my views. Making sure that we truly understand our own doctrine. That's my hot take. Cause I hear a lot of people talk about like doctrine's broken here or doctrine's not good here. And, you know, my opinion is doctrine, military doctrine, our doctrine, it's a snapshot in time and it's going to change. I've looked at FSRs, I've looked at FMs, right? I've gone way back and they always change. They change after the fact most of the time, not during or before. So it's a bit of a false assumption there that our doctrine is going to lean forward and predict the future. But having discussions on it and writing, I think, is super important. Like, if you really think something's broken, write on it. Don't complain about it. You know, and I'm saying this from my personal position of where I work right now. You know, because the ideas are good to get them out there. But yeah, doctrine's important.
From my personal position, I would just say, but be careful because it could blow back in your face. And that's all I'll say about that. Keep going.
You know, so. With that, right, it's not perfect, and there's a time to deviate from it, but you got to know where to start to deviate from, right? And it is, okay, I see this. I know what it says. I know that this might not work in this situation. Let me try something different, because you have to evolve and you have to change and you have to adapt. And if you're stuck on the way something is written and not realizing that your operational environment has changed around you, you're probably going to fail. All right. So it's a balance, but people want to adapt before they even know what the book says.
It's funny. When I was several years ago, back when I worked at the armor school, we had this methodology there that was all about, there was no foundation and it was all just kind of shooting from the hip. And so you had all these brand new armor officers out there shooting from the hip. And you'd ask them a simple question, and they're like, "Well, I don't know that." And you're like, "Come on!" And so it's just funny because it's one of those things. It sounds great to give folks all this latitude, but you have to give folks latitude when they've proven that they understand the foundational ideas of whatever it is they're doing. Because I think I personally am not a huge fan of doctrine, just because I think the way that doctrine's currently written. It's very, let's see, what's the phrase here? Pass the torch to the next generation-ish. I also see like how it's written and who works on it. And that's very unimpressive. And I'm going to just stop going down that road because I don't want to like, get you into an awkward position. But anyway, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done on it. And I've banged away on that for a long time. So. Anyway, anything else, John, before I get you in trouble?
No, that's all good.
All right. Well, anyhow, that's it. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it. And I'll try and have you on again sometime.
All right. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media. We would also appreciate it if you would rate us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. The ratings help new listeners find the podcast just a bit easier. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.